Hello, this is Mary, and I'll be reading selections from the Decatur Herald and Review from Monday, July 28th, 2025. From the front page, Fun and Fish in Findlay. Walleye Festival, a big tradition for this small town, by Danette Beckett. Findlay. 4-year-old Brooks DeWitt eventually grew tired of all the candy he was given during Saturday's Findlay Walleye Festival parade. But he loves it, says his mom, Whitney. He loves gathering things and putting them in the bucket. To add a bit of change to the parade, one of the floats handed out watermelon and cantaloupe. Brooks suddenly found the energy he once had at the beginning of the parade. He's having a blast, DeWitt said. Several visitors lined the Findlay Walleye Festival parade route down the center of the village on Saturday. Along with the parade, car show, and family games, visitors had a day filled with walleye dinner. The connection between the community and the Walleye Festival is evident, according to DeWitt. It's just so special to keep all the things in this town, so we don't have to go out any further, she said. Patty Brooks agreed. We live in a wonderful sharing community, she said. It's a nice little town. Brooks and her husband Dave were honored as grand marshals for the festival. The couple are known around the village of less than 1,000 for their volunteer work. Our whole family does volunteer work, she said. The Brooks family's passion for helping others has blossomed into other cities, including as near as Decatur and as far away as Memphis, Tennessee. Several children and grandchildren are employed as emergency medical technicians, too. My brother and I both started out here in Findlay on the volunteer fire and ambulance, said grandson Quinn Brooks, 25. He went to be a medic in Decatur, and I went to Memphis. Walleye, offered up with fries or coleslaw, was also a draw for many visitors. The meals were served up in two locations, outside the walleye tent near the Findlay fire station, and inside the American Legion Hall. The Sons of the American Legion cook and serve walleye sandwiches with chips underneath the tent. More than 1,200 pounds of fish are prepared for the weekend festival, according to Craig Sidoris, festival committee members. On Friday evening, the opening of the festival, both groups served 400 pounds of fish, which was provided by a market. The American Legion members served up a walleye dinner with coleslaw and fries. According to Alan Morrison, senior vice commander for the Findlay American Legion, the larger meals and air-conditioned atmosphere weren't what brought people to their fundraiser. It's a great way to give back to the community and give back to the veterans, he said. Proceeds from the Sons of the American Legion meals will go toward renovations and other community updates. The American Legion uses the funds to support service organizations, such as Kemmerer Village in Assumption, as well as scholarships for Okaw Valley High School seniors and Shelby County Disadvantaged Veterans Groups. Although the meals are larger, Morrison admits he will venture out of the air-conditioned building for another fish meal. I love the walleye on a sandwich, he said. Sarah Perry is the treasurer for the Findlay Walleye Festival. But we all chip in every year that this takes place, she said. After nearly 40 years, the festival continues to grow, she said. Last year we had 16 vendors. This year we have 30, Perry said, and it's only going to get bigger and better. Also on the front page, Illinois courts. Judge dismisses Trump lawsuit. State's immigration policies to remain amid federal crackdown, by Brendan Moore. Springfield. A federal judge on Friday dismissed a lawsuit brought by the Trump administration that sought to invalidate Illinois state and local policies, claiming that they impede the federal government's crackdown on illegal immigration. The suit, filed in early February, alleged that the Illinois state law and Chicago and Cook County ordinances limiting cooperation with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement had the purpose and effect of making it more difficult for federal immigration agents to carry out operations within the state. It sought to have the laws tossed under the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution. But in her 64-page ruling, Judge Lindsay Jenkins found that the state and local decisions to not participate in civil immigration enforcement are protected under the 10th Amendment. Under the 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which outlines the powers held by the federal government and state government. Because the 10th Amendment protects defendants' sanctuary policies, those policies cannot be found to discriminate against or regulate the federal government, wrote Jenkins, who was nominated by President Biden in 2023. The Justice Department did not immediately provide comment on the ruling. It is a victory for Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker and state Democrats, who have enacted some of the nation's strong protections for immigrants in recent years. This court ruling shows what we already know. Illinois' law has always been and still is compliant with federal law, Pritzker's office wrote in a statement. Illinois ensures law enforcement time and energy is spent fighting crime, not carrying out the Trump administration's unlawful policies or troubling tactics. At issue was the state law known as the Trust Act, which was signed by then-Governor Bruce Rauner, a Republican, in 2017. It generally prohibits state and local law enforcement from assisting the federal government with civil immigration enforcement. Cooperation is permitted, however, when there is a federal criminal warrant. And, in 2021, Pritzker signed the Illinois Way Forward Act, which built on the Trust Act by additionally prohibiting the state and local governments from contracting with the federal government to detain immigrants. It also banned officials from sharing the immigration status of people in custody unless presented with a federal criminal warrant. Chicago has had sanctuary city status since 1985, though the interpretation of the ordinance has changed over the years. The state and federal policies are meant to foster trust between immigrant communities and law enforcement by ensuring that interactions do not result in immigration detention or deportation. The laws have long been the subject of ridicule among conservatives and immigration hawks who claim they impede federal officials from doing their jobs. Since the beginning of Trump's second term, the federal government has targeted the policies through litigation. Similar lawsuits have been filed in states like California and New York. There have been various proposals from Republican state lawmakers over the year to curtail or fully repeal the state law. They have not gotten far, however. Immigration has been a major flashpoint early in Trump's second term. In addition to the courtroom, the battle between Republican immigration hawks that control Washington and Democrats who run cities and states with so-called sanctuary policies on the books has played out in theatrical hearings on Capitol Hill. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson and other big city mayors testified before the House Oversight Committee in March on their city's immigration policies. In June, Pritzker appeared before the panel, along with New York Governor Kathy Hochul and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. Pritzker defended the state's immigration policies and chastised Congress for failing to enact comprehensive immigration reform. Republicans, however, criticized the Democratic governors, claiming that their policies harm public safety. Turning to page 2, Decatur crash sends man to trauma center, by Danette Beckett, Decatur. A driver sustained life-threatening injuries in an overnight crash on the northwest side of Decatur. According to a press release issued by Sergeant Brett Hill with the Decatur Police Department, Officers were contacted shortly after midnight Saturday to the area of 821 North Sunnyside Road in reference to a crash involving one vehicle. The initial investigation revealed that a white 2012 Buick Regal traveled southbound in approximately the 1,000 block of North Sunnyside Road and lost control at or near the railroad tracks, Hill stated. The driver of the car was a 25-year-old Decatur man. The passenger was a 19-year-old female, also from Decatur. Both the driver and passenger were transported to a local hospital by ambulance. The driver was soon thereafter transported to a local trauma center with life-threatening injuries, Hill stated, while the passenger was treated for minor injuries. The crash is being investigated by members of the Fatal Accident Investigation Team. Also on page 2, 23-year-old man was pilot killed in Northern Illinois crop duster crash by Erlene Hinton, Daily Gazette. Oregon. Alexander Lehman, 23, of Lena, has been identified as the pilot killed in Tuesday's crash near the Ogle County Airport. Ogle County Sheriff Brian Van Vickle released Lehman's name Wednesday afternoon, saying the Ogle County coroner had positively identified Lehman as the pilot of the crop-dusting plane. Lehman lost his life when the plane crashed near the Ogle County Airport between Oregon and Mount Morris. The small airplane landed upside down in a cornfield along the north side of Route 64 after hitting power lines. First responders found the plane engulfed in flames when they arrived on the scene. Fire crews from the Mount Morris Fire Protection District responded and quickly extinguished the fire. The pilot, the sole occupant of the aircraft, was located deceased within the wreckage shortly after the fire was brought under control. 7 power poles were impacted in the crash, causing electrical outlets for some people in the area. Xfinity Comcast transmission lines were also impacted, resulting in outages for some customers. Authorities blocked off a section of Route 64 between Mount Morris and Oregon for most of the day before reopening the road at night. The small airport is on the south side of the state highway and has one grass runway that runs west to east, parallel with the state highway. Lehman's charred plane remained in a corner of a cornfield located near the driveway of the Aframe Family Greenhouse, 2810 Route 64, Oregon. The greenhouse, about 25 yards from the plane's wreckage, was open at the time of the crash. Mount Morris Fire Chief Rob Huff said a customer at the greenhouse heard a crash and saw wreckage when they looked out. ComEd crews worked to redirect transmission lines and replace broken poles with new ones. Van Vickle said an investigation of the crash will be conducted by the National Transportation Safety Board and Federal Aviation Administration. Education. Efforts to reshape higher ed gain steam, by Heather Hollingsworth, Associated Press. Ken Beckley never went to Harvard, but he has been wearing a crimson Harvard cap in a show of solidarity. As he sees it, the Trump administration's attacks on the school echo a case of government overreach at his own alma mater, Indiana University. Beckley, a former head of the school's alumni association, rallied fellow conservative efforts to reshape higher ed gain steam. Boy, this is a weird paragraph here. I'm going to just start on another paragraph. No government effort to influence a university, private or public, has gotten more attention than the clash at Harvard, where the Trump administration has frozen billions of dollars in federal funding policy changes. But far beyond the Ivy League, Republican officials are targeting public universities in several states, with efforts seeking similar ends. What's happening nationally is now affecting Indiana University, said Beckley, who brought Harvard caps in bulk and passes them out to friends. Officials in conservative states took aim at higher education before President Donald Trump began his second term, driven in part by the belief that colleges are out of touch, too liberal, and loading up students with too much debt. The first efforts focused on critical race theory, an academic framework centered on the idea that racism is embedded in the nation's institutions, and then on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Since Trump took office, officials in states including Indiana, Florida, Ohio, Texas, Iowa, and Idaho increasingly has focused on university governance, rules for who picks university presidents and boards, and how much control they exert over curriculum and faculty tenure. As at Harvard, which Trump decried as overly influenced by liberal thinking, those state officials have sought to reduce the power of faculty member and students. They've realized that they can take a bit of a step farther. They can advance their policy priorities through those levers they have through the state university system, said Preston Cooper. In Indiana, Braun said he picked new trustees who will guide the school back in the right direction. They include an anti-abortion attorney and a former ESPN host who was disciplined because she criticized the company's policy requiring employees to be vaccinated against COVID-19. Broad's administration ramped up scrutiny of hiring practices at colleges statewide. Indiana's Attorney General Todd Rokita sent letters to the University of Notre Dame, Butler University, and DePauw University, questioning the legality of their DEI programs. Butler, a private liberal arts school in Indianapolis, was founded by an abolitionist in the decade leading up to the Civil War, and admitted women and students of color from the start. "I hope that Butler will uphold the standards they were founded on," said Edith Curry, president of Butler's Black Student Union. In Florida, the State University System Board in June rejected the longtime academic Santa Ono for the presidency of the University of Florida, despite a unanimous vote of approval by the school's own Board of Trustees. The unprecedented reversal followed criticism from conservatives about Ono's past support for DEI programs. That followed the conservative makeover of New College of Florida, a small liberal arts school once known as the state's most progressive. After Republican Ron DeSantis appointed a group of conservatives to its governing boards, many faculty left, including Amy Reed, who now manages a team focused on higher education at the free expression group PEN America. When our students started organizing at New College, one of their slogans was, "Your campus is next," said Reed, who saw the gender studies program she directed defunded and then cut. So no, we're not surprised when you see other states refining what can be in a general education class, because we've seen it happen already. The changes at several public universities are proceeding without battles of the kind seen at Harvard. In a standoff seen widely as a test of private universities' independence, Harvard has filed lawsuits against the administration's moves to cut its federal funding and block its ability to host international students. In Iowa, new DEI restrictions are taking effect in July for community colleges, and the board that governs the state's three public universities is weighing doing something similar to Idaho, where a new law imposes restrictions on requiring students to take DEI-related courses to meet graduation requirements. Historically, the Iowa board has been focused on big-picture issues, like setting tuition rates and approving degree programs. Now, there's a perceived sense that faculty should not be solely responsible for academic matters, and the trustees should play a more active role, said Joseph Yockey, a professor at the University of Iowa College of Law and the former president of Iowa's Faculty Senate. What we started to see more recently is trustees losing confidence, Yaki said. A new law in Ohio bans DEI programs at public schools and universities and strips faculty of certain collective bargaining rights and tenure protections. There are few guardrails limiting how far oversight boards can change public institutions, said Isabel McMullen, a doctoral candidate at the University of Wisconsin who researches higher education. For a board that really does want to wreak havoc on an institution and overthrow a bunch of different programs, I think if a board is interested in doing that, I really don't see what's stopping them, aside from students and faculty really organizing against it, McMullen said. On page 2 of the July 28th edition of the Herald and Review, Female-Friendly Uber Service Coming to U.S., by David Matthews. Uber said it's rolling out a new program for women in the U.S. that allows them to choose female riders or drivers. Across the U.S., women riders and drivers have told us they want the option to be matched with other women on trips, Uber said in a statement. Women customers will see an option called Women Drivers and choose a different driver based on the pickup time. Female riders will also be able to pre-book trips with women drivers. Only 1 in 5 Uber drivers are women, according to the company. Women drivers will be able to choose the women rider preference option in their settings to get paired with female customers. When we make our platform better for women, we make it better for everyone, Camille Irving, Uber's vice president of U.S. and Canada operations, said in a release. It's about giving women more choice, more control, and more comfort when they ride and drive. The setting debuted in Saudi Arabia in 2019 and has expanded to 40 countries, including Argentina, Australia, Brazil, Canada, Colombia, Egypt, France, India, Mexico, and Poland. Since then, the feature has expanded to 40 countries, completing over 100 million trips, the company said. The U.S. program is starting in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Detroit in the next few weeks, before expanding to other markets. Rival Lyft started a similar program in 2023 for women and non-binary users. The feature is another option intended to make the app safer. Uber reported 2,717 individual reports of sexual assault, with the overwhelming majority of victims being riders, in the years 2021 to 2022, according to the company's most recent U.S. safety report. Turning to page 6, National and World News, The Digest. Boeing expects strike as workers reject deal. Boeing company experts expects more than 3,200 union workers at 3 St. Louis area plants that produce U.S. fighter jets to strike after they rejected a proposed contract Sunday that included a 20% wage increase over 4 years. The International Machinists and Aerospace Workers Union said the vote by District 837 members was overwhelmingly against the proposed contract. The existing contract was to expire at 11:59 a.m. or p.m. Central Time Sunday, but the union said a cooling-off period would keep a strike from beginning for another week until August 4th. Union leaders recommended approving the offer, calling it a landmark agreement when it was announced last week. Organizers said then that the offer would improve medical, pension, and overtime benefits, in addition to pay. Illinois. Joseph Suba, 73, a landlord sentenced to decades in prison after he killed a Palestinian-American boy and wounded his mother, died Thursday in the custody of the Illinois Department of Corrections, according to a statement from the Will County Sheriff's Office. Ukraine War. Russia scaled down the festivities honoring its navy Sunday, citing security concerns, as continuing Ukrainian drone strikes posed a challenge to the Kremlin. Russian authorities canceled warship parades in St. Petersburg, on the Baltic, and in far eastern port of Vladivostok. Germany. At least 3 people were killed and others seriously injured Sunday when a regional passenger train derailed in southern Germany, authorities said. Federal and local police said the cause of the crash near Reidlingen was under investigation. California. 2 people were found unresponsive, and the search continued Sunday for a third person after a small airplane crashed in the ocean off the central California coast, authorities said. Terrorism assault charges planned in Walmart attack. Traverse City, Michigan. A man accused of entering a Walmart in Michigan and randomly stabbing 11 shoppers before being detained by several bystanders in the store parking lot is expected to face terrorism and multiple assault charges, authorities said Sunday. Grand Traverse County Sheriff Michael Shea said a motive behind the attack by Bradford Gilley, 42, of Afton, Michigan, remains unclear. Gilley, who Shea said had prior assaultive incidents as well as controlled substance violations, said very little as he was detained by authorities. He is expected to be charged with 1 count of terrorism and 11 counts of assault with intent to murder. He remains in the county jail. Shea praised the quick response from law enforcement officers, who arrived within 3 minutes of receiving the call about the stabbing, but also a group of bystanders who intervened and detained Gilley in the parking lot. Calls began coming into authorities at 4:43 p.m., and a sheriff's deputy arrived at 4:46 a.m. I cannot commend everyone that was involved enough. When you stop and look from the time of the call to the time of the actual custody, the individual was detained within 1 minute, Shea said at a news conference. Gilley's name did not appear Sunday in Michigan's online jail records. Messages left Sunday with phone numbers and an email listed for Gilley were not immediately returned. His previous court cases did not have an attorney's name listed in public records. Turning to the sports page, Sunday results from Major League Baseball for local teams include: in the National League, the San Diego Padres defeated the St. Louis Cardinals 9-2. The Chicago Cubs defeated the Chicago White Sox 5-4. The current standings after the weekend's game include: in the National League, the Cubs and the Brewers are tied for first place with a record of 62-43. A 3-game series with the Cubs in Milwaukee begins today. And in the American League, the Chicago White Sox are in last place in the Central Division with a 38-68 record. In WNBA action over the weekend, our two local teams, Indiana and Chicago, the Fever defeated the Sky 93-78. Sports on TV tonight include Major League Baseball at 9:40 p.m. on the Major League Baseball Network, the New York Mets at San Diego, or Pittsburgh at San Francisco. On ESPN at 8 p.m., WNBA, the New York Liberty versus the Dallas Wings. On FS1 and FS2, men's basketball, 6 p.m., the basketball tournament quarterfinals at 6 and 9 p.m. And there is some tennis at 11 a.m. on the Tennis Channel with the early rounds of the Canada ATP and WTA. We'll take a short break and return with the reading of the Decatur Herald and Review from Monday, July 28th, 2025. Please stay tuned.